we switch you to the state capitol, where His Excellency, the Governor, is speaking from the Executive Mansion.
Further, I have, in conjunction with the federal government, declared this state to be a disaster area.
I was sent to keep you here until they come.
To kill me.
Vampires, alive among the lifeless, that make the night hideous with their inhuman cravings. If they are not destroyed in the flaming pits of hellfire, or staked to the ground in the light of the sun, will the unbelievable become real? A world of inanimate zombies by day? Irresistible, horrifying attackers by night? Can a zombie woman's hunger for love repopulate the earth?
Has it been since you had yourself a big hot screaming ear full of forgotten horrors? Well, that's too long. Pull in close now for a crepuscular half hour or so of the Forgotten Horrors Podcast with your hosts, John Woolley, Michael H. Price, and my own self, Wolf Brand Jack.
And thank you, Wolf Brand Jack. Thank you, Michael H. Price. I'm John Woolley, and on behalf of Michael and Wolf Brand, welcoming you to another Forgotten Horrors podcast. Michael, how are you?
Ready to roll. Glad to be here. Been a hectic day.
Good. Well, let's just relax and talk about a film that I guess I never realized just quite how good this picture is. And you know, you look online, you look in books and stuff, and it's got a very wide range of opinions about it. But what we're talking about here is, of course, Last Man on Earth, the Vincent Price version, from 1964. Mm-hmm. Went out as the second half. Well, actually, AP didn't have a second half of Double Bills, did they? They were both two B pictures, but went out with Circus of Horrors, which was the bigger picture, on 7th May 1964. It was a color picture, and it was a pickup from AIP. If I'm not mistaken, or for AIP.
It would be an Italian production.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you know, I mean, Circus of Horrors had no Hollywood pedigree except that it got picked up.
Right, and it had Anton Differing as the star. So, I mean, right?
Mm-hmm. And partially financed by AIP in the assurance that they would indeed get a piece of it in the States. And of course, that had a lot of baggage to it. It generated a hit record.
Sure did. Reach for a Star.
Yeah, exactly.
Actually, two versions of the hit record, right?
I believe that's right.
Yes, one was American, and it was covered, and I'm trying to think of the guy. Dadgummit, I'll tell you what, once I hit 70 years old, anything that has a capital letter, I can't remember. Buzz Kaysen is who I'm trying to remember. Buzz Kaysen took a name not unlike the name of the British guy who had cut Reach for a Star and recorded it, and I believe had the bigger hit with it in America, if I'm not mistaken. Right.
Yeah, well, it had the better payola.
That's well, there you go. There you have it. All right. Our producer likes to keep us kind of structured here. So basically, it's very easy to tell the plot first, which we like to do to set things up, of Last Man on Earth. It's basically a day in the life of the last, or apparently the last human being on Earth, who's out trying to eradicate his city of the zombies that have been created because of some weird bacterium that has swept through Europe and America. It's supposed to be America. It's not. It's Rome. But it's got that really, because it's Rome and because it's got Vincent Price in it, and he's talking about it like it's American. He even has, you can glimpse California license plates on his station wagon. It's got this weird otherworldly feeling from the very beginning, because even as a kid watching it, I knew that wasn't America. It was supposed to be. So you've got that really disoriented kind of nightmarish quality from the very beginning. And so Vincent Price is holed up during the day, during the night, as the zombies, who are the ineffectual, slow, very weak zombies, are attacking him and his house. And then during the daytime, he goes out and he finds them and tries to kill them. And then things get complicated from there. Of course, it's based on the Richard Matheson novel, I Am Legend, from 1954, which has been the basis of what, three films now? Omega Man?
I believe three. And then, of course, that's not counting the tremendous influence on George Romero's Night of the Living Dead.
You anticipated where I was going, Michael. So that's basically the plot. And it's, I'll tell you, it's told in voiceover, which doesn't work a lot of times. But I really think it works this time, because it's like a lonely guy. And this is a very lonely picture, especially the first two thirds of it.
Mm-hmm.
A lonely guy talking to himself. That's what this is like. That
it's
voiceover.
Not a narration so much as it is like an epistolary narrative.
Yes, yes. As when he says things, I can't live a heartbeat away from hell and forget it.
Yeah.
That's not a narrative. That's, you're right. It's epistolary. And he does that a lot in it. And just enough narrative drive, or just enough exposition, to let us know what's going on. But, you know, when he talks about going to Madison Street to 31st Avenue, I don't believe that for a second. It's in Rome, and it just everything, and it's so disorienting, and it's so lonely. It's such a lonely picture.
Did you see this picture first on television or in the theater?
I first saw it in the theater. I think I may have seen it with Circus of Horrors.
This is producer Joey Hambrick. I'm just stepping in just for a second here to added a little bit of an addendum. We realized after we recorded the podcast that Circus of Horrors actually came out in 1960, which would have been 4 years before Last Man on Earth. The song from that movie, Look for a Star, was a hit in 1960, so we still can't figure out what the other half of that bill was that John Woolley watched. It was possibly pyro. I don't know if you guys have any ideas out there. You might put something up on the Forgotten Horrors Facebook group. Anyway, even though this information was wrong right here, I just liked the talk of Circus of Horrors, and I thought there was some good information in there, so I left it in. Thank you. Bye.
Oh, yeah, I caught it on a double bill at one of my uncle's theaters.
Oh, yeah, your Uncle Grady?
Yeah, which of course, you know, with Grady had three theaters in our hometown. One was for the big Hollywood blockbusters, one was for the art films or imports, and the one that I preferred to visit was the State Theater, which had a steady run of B movies.
What was your do you remember what your impression was as a kid?
I remember just like feeling numbed by it.
Yeah.
Circus of Horrors is very exciting.
Yes, it is. It's got all the high wire acts, and it's got, you know, people having knives thrown into their necks and stuff. But,
and it reminded me of another Vincent Price picture, that is Circus of Horrors did, an earlier picture that Vincent had done called The Big Circus.
Right.
Like, whoa, this is, and of course, as a circus picture, as a horror film. Circus of Horrors is entirely conventional. Its plot goes back to the old monogram B movie conceit of restoring beauty via sadistic means,
Which was very big in European pictures as well, wasn't it?
Heavy duty, and I like to think that probably originated or really took its shape with monogram pictures. They repeated that gizmo law
with Bela Lugosi, usually right in those
King of the Zombies, Revenge of the Zombies, a lot of the Lugosi pictures at monogram. And of course, probably took its origins from the silent films of Lon Chaney.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah,
but you get the crystallization there, and all of a sudden it's like, wait, haven't I seen this movie before? I did not think that when I was watching The Last Man on Earth. Haven't I seen this movie before?
It's like, no,
I've never seen anything like this before.
Hugely low budget. It's just obviously very, very low budget, and yet that works for it instead of against it. That threadbare look is somehow, to me, symbolic of the life that Vincent Price's character has. Just so, you know, all he's concerned with is just existing, and he puts there's one beautiful scene where he puts the jazz record on the phonograph, and they sort of, and I know that, you know, Sidney Salkow was not, you know, known as a great director. He's a very workmanlike director, but that particular scene where he goes from the recording of this sort of blaring jazz out to the zombies that are pounding on the front of his door is just stunning. It's just beautiful.
It's got a documentary.
It does. It absolutely does. Absolutely does.
And then, you know, I mean, it's like, there had never been another picture quite like it. There had been similarly desolate pictures like, for example, Daughter of Horror. But none that felt like, you know, I kept expecting Walter Cronkite to show up and say, "You are there."
Yeah, right. And you know what it felt to me like, Michael, when I watched it this last time, when Joe and I watched it? It felt like Detour for some reason. I think it's because it's that haunted protagonist, main character, and there's some voiceover in Detour as well, but just the whole idea of he just seems doomed from the very beginning. It's a sad life to start with, and then it just gets sadder, and it's just, it's an amazing thing to me. And you start thinking about Vincent Price, and I know one of the reasons Richard Matheson took his name off this particular version and went as Logan Swanson, which I think is his mother's maiden name and something else, but was because he thought that Price was miscast. And Price, granted, I mean, he's not an action hero when he's throwing these people around, but he's very convincing as an everyman. And this is the year, I mean, he's doing what? He's doing Tomb of Ligeia. He's doing Mask of the Red Death. There's been a beach party picture in there. There's been coming up is in Italy. He's doing Dr. Goldfoot and the Girl Bombs. Between after Dr. Goldfoot and the McKinney Machine. And so he's doing all kinds of stuff. And you knew him a little bit, and you were and are distant cousins. Is that correct?
We never did a genealogical search, but we traced certain ancestors back to the, colonial times in West Virginia. And in fact, I know we were doing our first interview, 1975. George Turner and I had gone out to meet Vincent at the Amarillo Airport to interview him in advance of a lecture he was doing at the local cattle college. we were just yakking it up. You know, he was talking about favorite assignments, as both you and I tend to get our interview subjects going on.
Yes.
He was bringing up Drakenwick and Seven Gables and Shock.
With Lynn Barry, yeah.
One of the wonderful bad doctor movies. And he stops in mid-sentence and says, "Your last name, where'd your family come from?" I brought it out and he says, "You too, huh? sticks out his big old hand and says, "Well, shake, cousin." we just took it on faith from there that we had some kind of a blood kinship. And which was, you know, when I was in junior high school, I'd take a date to the latest Vincent Price movie and said, "You see that scary guy up there? That's my uncle." I thought I was lying. Turned out.
No, it kind of was, wasn't it? Yeah.
No way it was. Yeah. So, we stayed in touch for the long haul, and frequently, I'd come into my newspaper office some years later in Fort Worth, and the security guard at the desk would say, that guy came to see you. I said, "What guy?" He said, "You know, the scary guy." "Oh, I think I know who you mean." And I'd go up there, and it'd be Vincent Price kicking back in my office waiting for me to get back from lunch. And he'd say, "Let's go play hooky."
And wow.
We'd go out to one of the art museums in Fort Worth. Or sometimes it would be a home and garden show that he was working to promote his signature collection of fine art reproductions.
And then he also had that huge cookbook, right?
Oh, again, you know, he'd do cooking demonstrations at these trade shows.
Wow!
Amazing, wow. Yeah. But we were traversing the Amon Carter Museum, which at the time was big on frontier art.
Yes.
Its scope considerably since then. This would have been in the late '80s, early '90s, and a patron of the museum lady comes running up to us and gets in Vincent's face and says, "You're him." "Why, madam, I'm certain I don't quite know what you're talking about." Turns and winks at me. "I know you. You're, don't try to deny it. You're him. You're that guy." And it's, does some hemming and hawing about and trying to be polite, and she's not trying to be polite. She says, "Don't tell me you're not Boris Karloff." Walks off in a huff. Turns Vincent to me and says, "She left before I could tell her I was Christopher Lee."
Do you recall if he ever said anything at all to you about this picture?
Oh, yeah, it was in passing during one of the early interviews, and somehow the subject of the first remake came up.
The Omega Man?
Yeah, with his old pal Chuck Heston.
And
he mumbled something about it, said, "You'd think we hadn't done it right the first time." Mm-hmm. And, of course, he didn't disparage the film, not nearly in the same way that he would disparage David Cronenberg's remake of The Fly.
Oh, really? He'd get all over that, huh?
He did, in fact, say, "You'd think we hadn't done it right the first time." And, of course, he despised excess.
Yes, yes. He was a man of restraint, wasn't he?
Yes, and The Cronenberg Fly is a very excessive film. I wouldn't have gotten into an argument with Vincent about it to save me, but I admire both.
Well, and I admire both Last Man on Earth, and there are some excesses in Dr. Goldfoot and the Girl Bombs, too, aren't there?
Well, I mean, he knew how to slice the ham.
Oh, he could chew every stick. He was like Carradine. He could chew every stick of scenery on the place.
He was embarrassed about, but he did despise gore.
Yes, yes. Uh-huh. Yes. He did. And a lot of those old line guys did. Karloff did as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you and know? Vincent, toward the end of his life, Vincent got bamboozled into doing what turned out, to his disappointment, to be a gore movie.
Theater Blood?
No. Theater Blood is kind of a model of restraint, even though it is not as restrained as many of his other pictures. But, a picture called From a Whisper to a Scream.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. Shot down that Clu Gulager, my friend Clu, is it? Clu and Miriam, his wife, do that sort of crazy, twisted Tennessee Williams brother and sister thing in that. That's an anthology picture, yeah.
It's one of those portmanteaus.
Yeah, Yeah.
I saw it under another title originally, but the formal title was From a Whisper to a Scream.
The Offspring is what you saw it as, probably. Yeah.
The first release title, but mm-hmm. the distributor officially changed that to a, at least they gave it a more subdued title.
Right, but, right.
Benson said he had been shown a script without splatter.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they and he shot his scenes accordingly, when he found out what they had put him into with his scenes having been shot separately, he was appalled. And he said the only thing that made up for that lost year was his being able to work on The Whales of August in nearly a starring role, a major supporting role with Lillian Gish and Betty.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And a very tender, sentimental movie, and Vincent's role is probably the core of that sentimentality in the film.
Well, you know, another thing that that was a high spot for him during, 63, I guess, when he was making, or early 64, when he was making this one, was mm-hmm. the fact that he and his wife got to travel to Italy and go to all the art museums and all that sort of thing. And at that time, remember, that was when AIP had, and I don't think this was one of those pictures, but AIP had entered into an agreement with an Italian filmmaker to co-produce pictures, mm-hmm. Having with two American stars. I believe actually Dr. Goldfoot and the Girl Bombs was one of them, that would have two American stars and different things. And then they would pool their resources that way. And at that time, Italy was the biggest European market for films. It was bigger than Britain.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Sam Arkoff and James Nicholson knew that. And got into a co-production deal there. And, you know, at first, I'm sure you did this research too, but at first, when this film first got started, the adaptation of I Am Legend, Anthony Hines was involved. It was going to be done by Hammer, apparently, and huh? Fritz Lang was supposed to direct. Well, a lot of what I've read is, well, that's sure a long drop from, you know, Fritz Lang to Sidney Salco. But, you know, Sidney Salco was a pretty workmanlike guy. He got the stuff done. And you look at his credits and they stretch back. He did a lot of B pictures, but they stretch back to the mid 30s. And he did like several of the Lone Wolf, those little great little Warren William B pictures for Columbia.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he did a bunch of those.
He did a lovely, not a Poe picture, but a Poe-like presentation of Nathaniel Hawthorne called
Twice Told Tales. Joey and I were talking about that before we started recording, and of course, Vincent Price is in that, too.
Right, and old Serpico, yeah, he was a fine Western director, worked on mm-hmm. a lot of network television, and... Well, a lot of anthology TV,
right, right.
series, and very versatile, very versatile. The idea of his coming out of the B movie cauldron,
mm-hmm.
I think Columbia Pictures,
yes,
and then broadening himself out when he could see the television was really, really putting Hollywood through the ringer.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Became perfectly adept at that. I remember most fondly he worked on some of the Warner Brothers westerns and that great film noir TV series 77 Sunset Strip.
That's right. I was going to bring that up. What a wonderful show that was. Mm-hmm. I think only next to Peter Gunn in terms of really getting the noir thing right.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. And the thrills that weren't cheap.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely.
Fighting action and some wonderful supporting characters. The definitive white guy hipster, Ed Byrne.
Yep. Yeah, Ed Byrne. That's exactly right. And you know, and he, whatever material he was handed, he seemed to do well with. And, you know, this film reminds me of what James Gunn, and I'm not quoting him exactly, but the director who did Slither, which I think is a very underrated picture, the second Slither, not the one James Caan, but horror movie. He said that zombies are loved ones who have turned against us.
Ooh.
And I really think that that is the key in this film, Last Man on Earth. The loved ones do turn again. And the guy Vincent Price's character's pal is a guy that is in like every other horror film that came out of Italy for about 20 years, you know, Giacomo Rossi Stewart.
Oh, yeah.
Jack Stewart, he went by a lot, but Giacomo, I think I'm saying his name right, Giacomo Rossi Stewart. And, you know, you look at him and you look at his wife and you even look at the child and you're thinking, these people aren't American. What are they exactly? They're trying to be American, but it's not. It's just another way that it's just so off kilter. The whole experience of watching this picture is off kilter.
Otherworldly.
And the thing about it is, once again, I don't know if the copyright expired or something, but you can see it, a beautiful print for free of this picture on YouTube.
Excellent.
You know, it's absolutely beautiful. And I would really recommend it. I don't want to overstate it. It's a small, dark, lonely, disorienting picture that the major difference I see, we haven't even talked about this, Michael, but see what you think. The only real big difference between Night of the Living Dead and this in terms of just in terms of the structure is the ending. The difference in the endings, they have the same downbeat ending, but one is full of religious imagery and one is devoid of it.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that seems to be the difference between the two pictures, about the only difference between the two pictures, really.
Pretty amazing. Yeah. It's like, I cast no aspersions under George Romero.
Absolutely not. He did a wonderful job. No.
Took a good idea and embellished.
Yes.
Yep. And of course, utterly Americanized. I mean, Pennsylvania mm-hmm. could be anywhere in the country, that heartland. Funny though, much as I like both pictures, I always gravitate toward the Italian Vincent Price.
Isn't that funny? And I don't like foreign horror movies all that much. I'm very ethnocentric in that way. I love the stuff made here, you know?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
But I'm with you. I'm absolutely with you. And I really think it's, if you haven't seen it, folks, I think it's really worth a look. We don't want to, again, we don't want to oversell it. It's not a blockbuster. It's a quiet and disturbing little picture.
Yes.
And speaking of quiet and disturbing, what have we got out there on the marketplace if people want to help support the Forgotten Horrors franchise? I know we seem to be getting some fairly robust sales out of there on the Fantasies in the Sand.
Fantasies in the Sand is looking pretty good. Considering it hasn't had a blockbuster promotional campaign.
That's right, right, exactly.
Last Man on Earth.
Right, right.
But, you know, I mean, we have the good fortune to have a built-in audience,
mm-hmm.
and you don't want to take that for granted. But very nice to have that. You know, I mean, as of this year, Forgotten Horrors has been around for 40 years.
Oh, my Lord, really? Oh, Michael, that's amazing. You're not that old, are you?
Well, who is, you know?
That's right,
I'm not woofing you. It was the first British edition of Forgotten Horrors came out in 1979.
79, that's right. Hey, that's right, 89. Boy, you're right, absolutely. And if people want to kind of start at Forgotten Horrors, if they would listen to the podcast, let's say, and thinking about getting one of the books, and of course they're most of them available, are all available now as downloads as well as hard copies.
I believe we've got practically all the titles in Kindle editions.
Okay, and if somebody wants to try them out, should they start with Numero Uno, you think?
Oh, sure, you know, and later on this year there will be a comprehensive omnibus Forgotten Horrors containing volumes 1 and 2.
Okay, good, good. Well, you know, I think they could also, if they wanted to deal with Forgotten Horrors, the Nth Degree is a good place to enter, too.
One of course, that's
one of my favorites, too. Of course, it's because I'm involved in it, but it is a lot of the well, we've expanded and worked with the columns that we did for Fangoria, you and I, and the Forgotten mm-hmm. Horrors columns for so many years. And plus, you added some wonderful stuff to it as well. And there is some really, really good stuff, I think, in that. And I would like to direct people toward the novel I wrote with Robert A. Brown as well. The second volume is coming out here in a couple of months. You were nice enough to do the flap copy for us on the first one, and we seem to be doing well with it. And it's called Seventh Sense, and it's available as well on Kindle and BarnesandNoble.com and Amazon.com and all over the place. So if you would like to support us, we would humbly ask that you look at some of that stuff. And if it interests you, please buy it. We want to be maybe sort of, what is it, subliminal? And maybe we should say this like during the, while we're doing our narration, just stop and say, buy our books, and then just go on. however we want to do it. But anyway, we do appreciate you listening. And next time around, we've got, it's a horror movie, but it's a horror movie of a different type, isn't it?
Oh, it's a horror movie for these very days we're living in.
It is. And it has in it some of the great horror writers. Including Charles Beaumont, who wrote the script, guys you know from Twilight Zone, and Richard Matheson, the you star bet. Of I Am Legend. And it's also got my friend Frank Robinson, who has a small part in it as well. And he's told me some stories about being down south and him being a gay man from Chicago, being down south doing a film about a rabble-rousing segregationist, played by William Shatner, was quite an experience for him. And the film is quite an experience, too. It's the film that made Roger Corman realize he was never going to make another message picture again because it never made any money, even under different titles like I Hate Your Guts and I Shame and I don't know what all. But the name of the film is The Intruder. And it was written by Charles Beaumont, and it stars William Shatner. And that's what we're going to be working over next time around.
Nice work if you can get it.
It is indeed. So please join us and thank you so much. It's always great to have you along. Michael, talk to you soon.
Won't be long. How's it look, Joy?
That's great.
All right, good. Michael, great. Sounds good to me.